Welcome to the Student Loan Planner podcast, where the consultants have taken over because our fearless leader, Travis Hornsby, is out on paternity leave. He did welcome a beautiful baby girl into the world, healthy and safe. Wife is doing just fine. So everybody give a shout out to Travis when you get a chance. Today, you get Lauren and Justin, and we're talking all things physician student loan debt. Justin, say hi.
Hey, everybody. Glad to be here. What's up, Travis, if you're listening? We are still working while you're gone. Really happy for you and Christine.
Well, as we think about all the things that physicians deal with, you know, the first thing I kind of wanted to talk about was this idea that we're married to them. So not only are we doing regular consults on physicians, but you're running a practice, Justin, where you work specifically with anesthesiologists. And then we both decided to walk down the aisle with physicians. So why don't you start by telling us a little bit about how you found your physician wife?
Yeah. So my wife, Sarah, is from Portland, Oregon. And I'm from, I was living at the time in Philadelphia, and we met, I was out there for a weekend visiting a friend, and we were introduced by a mutual friend and kind of hit it off, but kind of not. And I was like, oh gosh, I'm super busy in Philadelphia. I'm working hard. I'm renovating this house. I'm working a full-time job. I'm intrigued by this beautiful young MS3 that I just met, but I'm also not interested in, like, I hilariously said, I think I'm too busy for a girl in the suburbs. I kind of need a girl within like a 6-block radius because of how my life is structured right now. And it turns out that there was Sarah, who was across the country, who ended up running away with my heart. So to tell make a long story short, we had a long distance relationship for a while. She ended up matching in Philadelphia. Fortunately, she's like super smart and competent and could have gone wherever she wanted. And I'm obviously not biased at all. And she ended up coming here for residency, where she is now. She's just concluding her fourth year of anesthesia residency. She's one of the chiefs here at University of Pennsylvania. I'm very proud of her. And she's doing a great job. It has given me a very unique perspective, not only on student loan debt, which we are dealing with, but also just the lifestyle challenges, the demands of residency, and of, frankly, just like relationship, marriage, family with a physician spouse. It can be pretty intense at times and uniquely challenging in certain ways.
I think it definitely is probably pretty challenging when you have a brand new child in your household as well, right?
Right. Yeah.
The parameters on which you have to figure out how to take care of baby, be a loving spouse, also throw yourselves full time into your work. Talk a little bit about like how you guys are managing that.
With a nanny is the short answer. But the longer answer is, you know, communicate as much as possible, try to share calendars and scheduling and try to make space and prioritize the time together that we do have, and intentionally like block out Wednesday night, like 6 to 9 is the date night slot on my calendar. So if all else fails and we go for days at a time when she's on call and I'm working and we just keep on passing like ships in the night, we have a chunk on our calendar when we'll order some takeout and try to just get a little quality time together to just sort of touch base and be able to cultivate and tend to our relationship in ways that are really important, especially when you're working a very, you know, just demanding job and are busy and stressed. It's easy to be passive and let those things drift. And it's very important to not do that if you want to have a healthy marriage.
Are you listening, physicians out there? You too can have your cake and eat it too. You just got to find a little block. I actually was reading a book recently where a gentleman was dating a young lady that was in the midst of residency, and he would go sit in the emergency room in the middle of the night and, you know, 2 a.m. break, would go see her and hang out, or, you know, just make it work. He was a writer, so he would like kind of sit in the lobby and write. I don't know that I could do financial planning at 2 a.m. in the lobby of a waiting room, but yeah. Luckily I didn't have to. So.
Interesting. I think Sarah does not want me
anywhere
at her work while she's there, but that's an awesome story. And I think it does speak to the level of kind of commitment and the way you need to like make it happen. You need to make the room, make the time, make the communication happen. And then, you know, it can be great. And then whenever you get that time off, like that vacation block or whatever, you got to really unplug and be present, and, That's what it takes. And I'm talking like I've the master of this. I'm not. I'm just figuring it out in real time. We've been married a couple of years now, and I've quickly learned that this is like the bare minimum to be able to thrive together.
Bare minimum. Well, I am a little bit ahead of you. I think only slightly. My husband is done with residency and has been practicing. Actually, we're probably a lot ahead of you now. I think he's been practicing for 5 years. Oh my goodness, time is flying.
Time does fly.
Yeah, he's a radiation oncologist. And our story as how we met was he stalked me.
Yes. Unfortunately, Lauren, you're kind of famous. It was definitely asymmetrical as far as probably his ability to do that.
He is pretty persistent, though, and a very good stalker, if I do say so myself.
Nice.
9 years ago, he heard about me, saw me, like you said, Googled me, saw me in some races, etc., decided I was the love of his life, and sought me out via a dating service. So he signed up for a dating service. It went terrible for him. They're like, we have a 98% success rating. And he was like, well, it's not working out with the people you've introduced me to. And they're like, well, we're going to find you a match. And he's like, well, I like her. And he literally Googled, showed them me and said, this is actually who I like.
Wow. They're
like, we're going to find her for you. So originally he was brought into the fold as, you know, we want you to be on this reality TV show. And I was like, you want me to be on a reality TV show? No, thanks. And it was kind of like, you know, they painted it as if it was The Bachelor. And I was like, I'm not going to be on TV, like kissing five different guys to figure out who's the love of my life. And so if we fast forward a really long story short, they basically wanted him to be on the TV show because he looks like perfect made for TV. And if they were going to use me to get him on the show because he was looking for me specifically, and then I was like, I'm not going to be on the TV show. So they're like, okay, well, we also have a dating service and we have these gentlemen that are paying to be a part of our service, but we don't have young ladies that are also paying to be a part. So our job is to go out and find eligible women that could, you know, match well with our bachelor. So still didn't know that he was specifically looking for me. Here we go.
This is amazing.
I know. No one thinks, they're like, Lauren, this is not a real story. I'm like, this is actually a very real story. This is how we met.
How did we get to the 95 episodes of the Student Loan Planner podcast and this story has not been told already? I have no idea.
I don't know either. I try to keep it on the down low.
So. Well, not for long.
So I fill out all this paperwork to be a part of this quote unquote matchmaking service. And then overnight they have a match. And I'm like, how could you even go through all the documents that I sent you that quickly? Because they were only trying to hook me up with him. I met him. I was not that impressed. We spent about 30 days talking on the telephone before I actually met him. So he was living in Philadelphia as well. I was headed out to the pin relays.
Yeah.
And so that was our first date. And it was kind of like, meh. Yeah, he's okay. I'm not so sure. But we kept talking. He ended up moving to Houston. And then I followed him to Houston is the very long story short over a 3-year time period of just like, I'm not so sure. Okay, fine. I'll just move to Houston and see if I really like this guy. And here we are. We've been married now for 3 years, known each other for 9. And that's our story.
Wow. Sounds like both of our relationships have traversed a lot of ground, and that's amazing. Thank you for sharing that.
Yeah, he was a resident, and like I said, I survived the end of residency with him and then on to attending.
For radiation oncology, how long of a residency is that?
So he went to school forever. So my husband is an MD PhD as right. well. So he did a 5-year program and then a resident, the fellowship, and then a resident. Don't give me the lie. I feel like it was 17 years total. That's what he says when he tells people.
Okay.
So I feel like that might include undergraduate. So there's a lot of school.
Got it.
Very specialized.
Yeah, no kidding. My wife's doing anesthesia. That's a 4-year program. And then they often have like 1-year bolt-on fellowships, which she's not going to be doing a fellowship. But yeah, the experience of a physician as well as a physician spouse, I think is unique and worth acknowledging that it has its own, not only personal highs and lows, but also its own unique financial trajectory. And it's kind of weird that you have to go way into debt, like way, way into debt for med school. And in order to be able to make the salary that it will sort of enable you to earn. And interestingly, there's some other professions where you earn basically med school debt and you don't have a doctor salary. So for anybody listening out there who's thinking about options for, should I finance this veterinary degree or chiropractics, or there's a few others that basically kind of get screwed by the PSLF system. Just think long and hard if you're also considering med school.
Right. If you like biology, you should hedge your bets toward being a physician versus some other science related job that's going to get you lots of debt and maybe not as much income.
Yeah.
And this podcast is all about student loan debt, right?
That's right.
Like, okay, Lauren and Justin, get on with the show. Teach us something. We have lots of things to tell you about physician debt.
Yeah. And interestingly, Travis, I think it's been well documented on this show and with the emails and everything, the mental health impact of student loans. We had a situation the other day. We were hanging out with another resident physician friend who had a really tough shift. Trauma came in middle of the night, double gunshot wound, and the guy basically died on the table. And there was some, it was a kind of a dramatic case and very emotionally charged. And our friend was just really distressed at his playing a part in this and all the second guessing and like, oh, should I have done something different? I mean, I can only intuit that it's very intense from watching the people around me deal with it, but I don't have to go through that. But having said that, because it's so intense, one of the things that we see frequently, Lauren, is the compartmentalization that happens as a survival mechanism. Like you have so much of your brain space and your emotional energy dedicated to your vocation of medicine that things that are would really be the biggest thing that anyone else is thinking about, meaning like hundreds of thousands of dollars of debt that's getting higher and higher and higher every day as the interest piles up. You have to totally not think about it just so you can get through your shift or get through your first or second or third or fourth year of residency. And something that I've found on more than a few occasions, as I'm sure you have too, is that people will say, oh, this is so stressful. This is so intense. The patient experiences are so sometimes distressing. It just takes every bit of what I've got. And I can't even deal with my student loans. I'm going to worry about them when I'm making a lot of money and I can just start to pay them off.
That's exactly what I hear all the time. You know, sometimes they reach out to us because residency is completed or I'm getting ready to begin as an attending. And one of the things I bump into quite frequently is, like I said, I didn't deal with them. I might have been on forbearance for all 3 years of residency because I wasn't making a lot of money. I didn't have time to look into the income-driven repayment plans that exist. And so I've done nothing with these loans and now I'm ready to deal with them because I know I have a good income coming in. What I'd love to encourage physicians to do is to deal with them once on the front end, and then you could probably hit the I don't have to look at these anymore during residency button and then pick back up after residency or during fellowship, you know, kind of pull the blinders back again. But I understand that you have to compartmentalize, but you don't want to do so at the risk of maybe missing out on something that's really going to help you. And one of those things is public service loan forgiveness. I actually had a case fairly recently where the gentleman did get on an income-driven plan during residency, but never signed up for PSLF. And so 4 years of residency, a fellowship, and now working at a nonprofit as an attending. And so is on a really good track to be able to maximize PSLF, but is having trouble because he didn't fill out the paperwork initially whenever everything got started. And that is one really easy thing you can do to get your loans moved from. So let's say you're at Great Lakes, Navient, Nelnet. Those are some of the three big servicers. They would leave one of those servicers and head over to Fed Loans if you filled out your employer certification form. So simply getting that form and getting the loans in the right place will have your payments a much better, will give your payments a much better chance of being counted appropriately. So there are ways to kind of set it and forget it, but you don't want to forget it first and then go back and then try to have to, you know, wriggle and raggle with the various loan servicers or trying to get the plan proactively put in place.
That's a great point. And even if you're not going for forgiveness, even if you're in a specialty where you're like, I'm definitely doing private practice because all of the interventional pain, for example, like many of them are in private practice and I'm definitely going to own my own practice and I want to probably just pay them off. So I'm just going to not worry about it for a while. There's significant opportunity cost to not coming up with a cohesive plan during residency and fellowship. And I've worked with people who, even as private practice clinicians, did forbearance for 4 years of anesthesia residency and another year of interventional pain fellowship, 5 years of 6.8% piling up. And then they refi and then they start trying to pay it down. Whereas if they had done, for example, revised pay as you earn at the beginning, if they were an unmarried physician, which this person was.
The interest rate subsidy,
they cut it in half. So instead of 6.8% on $350,000, we're getting 3.4%. So what's 3.4% times 350K, 10, 15 grand, whatever that is, times 4 years. I remember calculating it and it was about an $80,000 differential. So from a payer experience, from a physician experience, this would have meant instead of doing forbearance for 5 years, get on revised pay as you earn and pay somewhere between $200 and $300 a month for 5 years. So call it $3,000 per year for 5 years. That's $15,000 out of your pocket. The total impact of that 15 grand over 5 years, 3,000, for 5 years is an $80,000 savings on the back end. Like, how excited do you think that physician would have been to get an $80,000 signing bonus when they left residency or fellowship? Mm-hmm. That's basically what they flushed down the toilet because they wanted to do this compartmentalization just a little too early, and they should have come up with a plan and then compartmentalized and said, okay, repay $240 a month, keep my head down, do my cases, and look up again in 5 years. That would have, you know, in hindsight, been a much more appropriate strategy, unfortunately.
Definitely. What you don't know can hurt you. So you got to just pull your head out of the sand momentarily and then jump back into the compartment, the compartment, I guess, the trunk. That's right. It's like, that's what a compartment is, right?
That's right.
What are some of the other things that you bump into? I know one of the things that I've bumped into recently is the lump sum payment for physicians that have PSLF available to them. So a lot of the various programs that exist now are offering something similar to a signing bonus, but it comes instead of giving cash to the actual employee, we'll give you a lump sum payment toward your loans. It sounds really awesome if you are in fact qualified for public service loan forgiveness, but if you're 6 or 7 years in, you know, why would I want to make a lump sum payment towards something that's going to get forgiven anyway? We don't want to do that. We want to, you know, save as much as possible. So what happens when someone says, hey, we'll give you $100,000 towards your loan balance and your loan balance is $400,000? Doesn't make a huge difference when 3 years from now you're going to get PSLF either way. And all it did was really, you know, help you pay down a loan that was going to get forgiven. I've actually had somebody successfully go back to their employer and negotiate to say, instead of giving me a lump sum payment toward my loans, could I set that money aside and pay it monthly on my loans? And so now they've eliminated their student loan payment to the tune of $100,000 over the next few years as they continue to pay. And they can really reap the benefit of that full forgiveness without any money coming out of their pocket, which gives them a better opportunity to save.
That's a really nice bit of black belt student loan jiu-jitsu there, is taking a signing bonus and spreading it out over time, or a student loan payment from your employer and spreading it out over time to eliminate the monthly payment and keeping them on track for forgiveness, it sounds like.
Yeah, I listened to a podcast that's called Negotiate Everything. And that's exactly what I told this young lady to do, was that, you know, circle back to them and see what you can do, because just because they said that's what they want to do doesn't mean that's exactly what they're locked into. Yeah. And I got an email back in all caps, super excited that she was able to change the terms. Now, not all programs are created equally. Some of them are just a, you know, flat, here's what we do for all people that are coming on, take it or leave it. In those cases, you've kind of really got a way. By paying these loans down, is it going to now make more sense for me to, you know, refinance them and pay them back? Or am I shooting myself in the foot in some way by getting extra money? Because we always think of a lump sum as a good thing, but it's not always a good thing when we're talking about various forgiveness strategies.
That's right. And sometimes it can actually burn you if that payment is going to be imputed income, and then you have to pay a tax bill on money that they gave you to pay off a loan that would have been forgiven anyway. So the net impact to you is actually like, in that $100,000 example, you're going to have a $30,000 tax bill that you have to pay. Mm-hmm. And it's just like sadness upon sadness. So definitely think all the way through that.
All the sad things. Another thing I always like to encourage physicians to do is to be mindful of the 2 years of low payments that you get if you're going for a public service loan forgiveness. So a lot of times you don't realize you have your low resident salary, 40 or 50K a year. And then once you finish with residency, if you, and like you said, whether you're going for taxable forgiveness or public service loan forgiveness, this is applicable. So you're going to have 1 year at that, you know, another year at that payment, because everything kind of happens a year in arrear. So you're submitting your 2019 returns right now in 2020 as you recertify, and on and on. So if you're a resident in 2020 making 50K, in 2021, you're going to submit that 2020 return, even if you became an attending. So you still got a year at your 50K as, you know, payments, small payments, even though you're now making your bigger salary. And then that next year in 2021, you know, usually you start your attending job halfway through the year. You finish up with residency in June and start attending in July. So now you've got a half year at, you know, your 50K, and then a half year at your 250K as an example. That's still a much lower salary than your full attending salary. So what I see a lot of times is people reaching out to us because they're freaking out, because they're like, oh my goodness, I'm an attending. I'm going to be kicked off of public service. I'm going to, you know, never qualify for pay as you earn or repay anymore. What do I do? And they're very pleasantly surprised when we explain to them that, you know, actually you have 2 more years of relatively low payments before your attending salary kicks in. And the attending salary is not going to, in fact, cause you to be kicked off of whatever program you're on.
That's a great point. I love the way you framed that with that two-year kind of on-ramp to the attending level payment. And one thing that I ran into once with a client, I had heard these stories but had never experienced it firsthand, but I was on the phone with a big servicer who's going to remain nameless because I don't know how that works with lawsuits and stuff, but I was on the phone with my client who had gone through residency, had done everything right, did the employer certification form, had been on IBR, was just sort of trucking along towards PSLF and wanted to attain it and transition from fellowship, from residency to attendinghood. When they certified that higher income, they received a notice that said, you don't qualify for IBR anymore. Give us a call to talk over options. We called them together because I was like, this feels weird. You're on IBR. You can be on it if you make 100,000 or 100 million.
Right.
They can't kick you off. It just caps out at the 10-year standard payment. So we're talking with them and they're like, yeah, we recommend that you get on revised pay as you earn because it's the only plan available to you that's going to qualify for PSLF, which you want. Now, imagine that Justin hadn't also been on this call. Ooh. And my physician client was like, oh my gosh, like 5 years I've been working towards this. And you're telling me now I got to pay these $3,000, whatever, the repay payments and I lose the cap. I thought I had the cap. I was stepped in. I was like, listen, like this is wrong. Please just double check. Go talk to your manager and come back to us. And they did. So it's like, we'll put you on hold 5 minutes. They come back. No, I wasn't wrong. You need to do repay. I was like, okay, can we talk to your boss? We go to the boss. And this happens over about a 45-minute period. And we explain the situation and the boss says, let me go, you know, look at something. They come back and like, yeah, you need to get on repay if you want to go to PSLF. And at this point, I'm like, I have steam coming out of my ears.
Right.
So I'm like, okay, I'm gonna read to you from the, you know, Department of Ed, student loan servicing rules. And like, you explain to me how this applies in this situation. And I said, you know, here's IBR, caps of the 10-year standard, your payment, you know, basically, I just read them the rules and I said, you know, please explain to me how we can stay on IBR because the rules clearly permit us to do that. And I think there's just a miscommunication here. So he put us on hold again. This is the third hold we've been on now.
Oh, no.
He comes back and says, you're right. I think there was a misunderstanding. We're going to send you a letter to document this and you should be in good shape. So the moral of the story is, unfortunately, there are well-documented cases in which servicers actively subvert people's attempts to get PSLF. And I think they're working on doing better now, but this is not at all an uncommon story. So be suspicious. If you're on pay as you earn or IBR and you're a physician and you're transitioning and you get a weird notice that says you no longer qualify for this capped plan, and that's an important asterisk there, IBR and pay as you earn are capped. You no longer qualify for this because you don't have financial hardship. Please call us to talk over options. You should have alarm bells going off in your head that say, I'm on IBR, I'm on pay as you earn, they can't kick me off unless you choose to leave. And if, don't leave. Whatever you do, don't leave that plan. Because once you no longer have financial hardship, once you're a few years into that attending salary, if you get off IBR, if you get off pay as you earn, your payment bumps up to that repay level, then you're locked out. You can't get back into the lower capped plans. And then you're lighting thousands of dollars on fire unnecessarily. And it's sadness upon sadness. We want to help everyone avoid that if at all possible.
All the sadness. Now, if I'm listening and I'm a physician, I'm like near tears, super overwhelmed right now because you're like, wait, what? They were wrong, but I call them and I trust them. And I think the thing that's most unfortunate about this and the thing that is really hard for all borrowers is that you're looking for someone to trust because you're not an expert in this, you know, particular category. And in the same way that physicians spend a lot of time developing expertise so that they can save people's lives and, you know, improve their health, they'd like to make the assumption that the person that they're calling at their student loan agency is doing the same, when in fact they're not. You know, they're actually usually poorly compensated, you're poorly trained, and, you know, reading from a screen, which is unfortunate because now that makes you have to invest more time. And we just talked about compartmentalizing. You know, you want to be able to bury your head and focus on the one thing that you got to do really well. But now here you are finding yourself having to babysit your student loan servicer or to, you know, sit on the phone for 45 minutes, which is a huge investment of time to sort through what's right and what's wrong. And that's where, like, I take so much pride in, you know, having become a student loan planner and doing this work with you all, because the expertise really matters. And I think we can really relate to the way the physician takes seriously the focus on learning this thing. Like you said, you knew the right rule and you were not hanging up the phone until they, in fact, said, hey, oh, we're the ones that are wrong, because it can change someone's financial lives by, like you said, not tens of thousands of dollars, but hundreds of thousands of dollars. If you just say like, okay, they must be right. I'm just going to hang up and do what you said. And
it's yeah. Okay. And that's what gets me super fired up. You know, it's like, can you please like stop intubating people in the ICU long enough to get on the phone with me so I can lie to you, make you make a $100,000 mistake, and then you can go back to doing what you're like. That is so, it makes me furious, just furious. So I'm really glad that that situation turned out well. And what we want to do now is just arm everyone out there with the knowledge that as you're transitioning as a physician into attendinghood, if you get one of these notices or you have one of these conversations, again, I think that some of the servicers are trying to train their people better. They also say they have this notice on your statement, like, FYI, like, you don't need to pay anyone to help you. You can like call us and we'll explain the option. They say it as if, and frankly, there are predatory student loan companies out there. And I affirm the truth of that in one way, but in another way, it's like, well, you also don't need to pay a doctor to get a medical exam. You can get it from anyone and ask their opinion, but it's not a good idea if you have a real problem. You need to go to an expert and you need to pay somebody when appropriate to get the good insight that you need. So I think enough said about that. I could soapbox on it for a long time, but it does get me super amped up, as you can tell.
Can you tell us a little bit about some of the things within your practice? You work, like I said, specifically with anesthesiologists. So you're dealing with this student loan debt all the time, but you're also dealing with physicians all the time. Is there anything in particular that anesthesiologists need to be thinking about, you know, maybe with public service or 501c3s or, you know, their work in general? Give us some expertise from the inside scoop.
Yeah, great question. So anesthesiology and pain management are two specialties with which I focus. And anesthesia, they're distinct from one another. Anesthesia is about a 50-50 split between physicians who go into academic medicine and ones who go into either big or small private groups. And that's obviously a dividing line for PSLF purposes. So one thing to think about as you're considering what are my options for PSLF or for forgiveness, you want to understand what part of the country you're going to be in practicing anesthesia. And you want to understand what are sort of the local options, because there are certain cities or certain regions that are totally dominated by one type of group or another. And you may find you're doing great for PSLF, and then you go to a part of the country or the practices you're most excited about are private practices, and the academic options are not really that good. And this is going to be a real conundrum for you. So if you have the foresight to say, I know I'm going to end up in this part of the country, think about the practice models that are predominant in that part of the country. And what does it mean for your forgiveness opportunity? That's something really important to think about. For interventional pain, it is frequently more private practice. There's obviously some academic, but if you're thinking about the forgiveness opportunity and you're going to be in private practice, then you're looking at the only forgiveness opportunity being the longer term 20 or 25 year forgiveness, which in most cases with a high earning physician who's going to start making 200 or 300 or 400 and scale up from there as they're successful in their practice, full repayment is going to make a lot of sense. So for the interventional pain docs, I usually say during residency, during fellowship, what are the things that we can do, like I described in that earlier situation, to mitigate the damage, to do something like capturing that repay interest subsidy for 3 or 4 or 5 years, so that whenever the time comes, when we finish training, we take that first attending role and we want to start crushing our debt, to position you for success with the minimum possible balance at the starting line. If we can start with 350 instead of 420 by making a really simple decision at the beginning, we definitely want to do that. So these are definitely relevant questions for this specialty specifically to be asking. One final thing actually that just came to mind is anesthesia is similar to emergency medicine in that sometimes there's private groups under like a nonprofit hospital, where a hospital anesthesia department might be farmed out to a private group. And so you might be working in a 501c3 in an academic hospital, but your employer, the person who signs your paycheck, might actually be a private group. So think hard again about this employment situation and what it's going to mean for your forgiveness, and be really careful, because if you're working at academic hospital ABC, but they fully contract out their anesthesia department and their critical care unit to a private anesthesia group, even though you're working in their building, you're not going to get PSLF credit. So that can be a real bummer if you're not prepared for that.
Yes, this was a really good one to bring up, Justin, because I bump into this all the time. We're in the middle of a consult and they're like, I'm really interested in PSLF. I know that blah, blah, blah hospital is. And then we're talking and then they say something about their, you know, the practice that hired them. I'm like, wait, what? And then I learn a little bit more and I find out that, yeah, they are hired by a for-profit agency that works within that nonprofit hospital. And they, in fact, do not qualify for public service loan forgiveness. So that's a very, very important distinction that you need to make as you're looking through the hiring process if you're trying to continue on a public service loan forgiveness route. I think one of the other things that we don't really talk a lot about, you know, we tend to focus on federal loans as student loan planner because there's so many strategies around them. But in physician world specifically, there's generally a lot more earning potential. And with that earning potential, sometimes comes the ability to pay the loans off and pay them off in full. And that being the most cost effective thing to do. So what should someone be thinking about as it pertains to possibly refinancing the loans, getting the debt off their plate and just moving on?
I think that this is a personal question. And this is one of those places, Lauren, I'm sure you run into this a lot, where you have to say, okay, here's what the math says. And then you have to do the emotional check to say, like, what do I actually want? I understand like the mathematically optimal course. And we talked about this a podcast or two ago. But what is the real world solution that is the Goldilocks answer? Mm-hmm. It's like, it's not too hot, not too cold, just right. Mm-hmm. And so understanding what that looks like for doctors, often they have the luxury of like, if I'm going to make a lot of money, maybe I'll get PSLF if I have a long training period and it works out. But because I'm making enough, maybe I just want to get out of debt 3 years earlier and it's going to cost me an extra $100,000, but I'm going to literally lose sleep until I'm out of debt and getting out 3 years earlier is worth it to me. I think it's great to self-reflect and evaluate if that could be a strategy worth pursuing. Have you seen that too, Lauren?
I've seen that quite a bit. And, you know, we've talked a lot about mental health today, and it is a very relevant factor. If you cannot get over the fact that I'm carrying this debt and it is just following you around like a ball and chain, peace of mind is a very, very important thing. And it is frequently worth paying for. So definitely, I never underestimate the power or the importance of, you know, how do you feel about this? As like you said, as financial planners, we're all about here's option A that is the most cost effective thing to do. Here's option B. And in light of the uncertainty, because we all have uncertainty in our life, you know, we've experienced it in 2020 via COVID and pandemic and all the different things that are happening. But regular everyday life, you know, with no pandemic, you can just turn a left corner and all of a sudden, oh, you know, I'm having a baby, or I'm not just having one baby, I'm having triplets, you know, all sorts of different things are happening. You know, jobs are not what we thought they would be, and we want to move to another place altogether, or, you know, the cost of living's too high on this side of the country, so I'm going to the other side. There are so many variables. And as your life unfolds, you've got to be able to say, all right, this is the best situation for me in light of what I know is going to happen. And this is also the best situation for me in light of what I cannot foresee happening. Even if that unforeseen happens, I feel like I can still tackle this in a, you know, cost-effective way.
Totally. And I'm curious what you think about this, Lauren. I think another category in which this applies for me is with the primary residence mortgage. So, you know, doing financial planning, and by the way, this is not financial advice, so please talk to a qualified financial advisor to advise you on your specific situation. But as I'm looking at this question and saying, what does the math say versus what is the, you know, the conventional wisdom, and what is the benefit, the psychological benefit of knowing that I own my entire house and the bank does not own any part of it? It's an interesting question. And I see myself as like, I kind of skew towards, I love the idea of like owning a house outright. And I think that when the time comes, and I could see myself paying off a mortgage aggressively. Now, having said that, having financing available like 2.5% is so stupidly low. It is, the market rates are testing my commitment to that idea where paying off a mortgage always makes sense. Like, dang, it's like borderline less than inflation right now.
Right.
Which is hard to say no to. What do you think about that?
It does. It once again comes back to personal ideas, personal values. I am very, very debt averse. And so I am one of those financial planners. While I can do the math and generally send my clients in the direction of like, you know, let's take care of this slowly. Let's tackle saving for retirement, you know, all these other financial goals we have. And maybe we can speed up our paying down our mortgage a little bit. You know, we don't generally prioritize that over other things that we're participating in, as, you know, I make financial plans for people. But I personally am one of those people who has paid their house in full because the security that I have of, you know, I just have to come up with property tax and insurance, and I could work at an hourly job flipping burgers or something and probably still get that done and keep the lights on. Like, I feel almost like I'm retired.
Yeah.
The freedom that comes from that was just like so amazing for me. And for other people, it's just like, man, this is, you know, this is normal. I got to pay a mortgage. Like, I'm not planning on stopping working. This mortgage is affordable. And, you know, I can do X, Y, Z with my other discretionary income. There's a trade-off there by being able to do one thing and not the other.
Interestingly, this is also a bit of a friction point with financial advice. And so anybody out there who's like, oh, I've got a financial planner and he told me like I'd be stupid to pay off my, you know, 3% mortgage and not invest it in the market. And like, if I can earn 7 in the market and my house is 3, like that, it's true. That's true. And if the mathematical relationship that we've experienced historically holds, then he's or she is not wrong. But it's important to note, if that advisor is managing a bunch of money for you and you're saying, hey, I want to sell $300,000 worth of stocks and take it out of the investment account that you're managing and maybe paying 1%
on my mortgage
and pay my mortgage off. What happens to the advisor in that situation? They're going to earn $3,000 less per year because you just blew up your investment account to do the thing that's going to help you sleep better at night. So I always say, follow the money, understand compensation, understand incentive attached to that compensation. And if you want to pay off your mortgage or if you want to pay off your student loans and you want to blow up an investment account to do it, understand how your advisor may interact with that question as it relates to their own comp, and because it's going to probably color their advice a little bit, potentially. Obviously, every advisor wants to be as objective as possible. Everyone wants to do what's right for their client. But there are conflicts of interest that creates these like weird dynamics where advisors are sometimes inversely incentivized to have clients pay off debt because they want to just manage money that they can bill.
Yeah, no, that's a very valid point. And, you know, we're very big proponents on SLP of fee only fiduciary and making sure that whoever you're working with is a CFP. But even people who meet all three of those requirements charge on what we call AUM. And it creates the same sort of conflict that you're talking about, Justin, because you know, that's, like you said, money going out of the investment accounts that you get paid on. So just to be mindful of that.
Yeah. One other thing to think about is I think it's interesting the way that the forgiveness programs are currently constructed. There are certain specialties, medical specialties, that by virtue of how much debt you need to take on in order to get there, the lower earning specialties, and I say lower kind of in air quotes, but kind of not, because if you need to go into $300,000, $400,000 or more of debt in order to make $150,000, $170,000, $180,000, like that's not a great deal in many cases. And if you're, for example, an academic pediatrics specialist, and you're making something like that, and you've gone into $400,000 of debt, and you're making $175,000, you're fully dependent on PSLF to bail you out. And there's these, I'll call them like wild asymmetries that exist, that there's whole specialties that literally no one would go into that if it wasn't for forgiveness, because you just couldn't make it work economically. So one of the things that I'm interested to see as student loan policy is sort of in the crosshairs a little bit and maybe is going to get revamped in the next 1 to 2 years, hopefully. What kind of provision are they going to make for these very important, but just not as high earning specialties? And how are we going to address the cost of med school? Like if every pediatrician had to go into $400,000 worth of debt in order to be a pediatrician and we're only going to pay them, again, it's kind of the low end, but $150,000, $170,000, are we going to have any? Mm-hmm. Now, the sort of the market capitalist person would say, well, if we don't have any, then the pay goes up. But it gets more complicated than that because of insurance and reimbursement and Medicare and all the sort of things messing with market forces. But it's an interesting question. What is the future of certain specialties based on student loan policy?
And I think you bring up a good point, too, that not all professions or all physicians are compensated equally. There's quite a vast and varying scale as there is, you know, across all professions in general. And I think one of the stigmas or one of the perceptions that, you know, people who look at physicians like, oh, they make tons of money, they're loaded, you know, they have very little sympathy for the big bag doctor that's taking all their money via this insurance, et cetera. But they don't realize, like you said, all those forces that are at play. So, yes, healthcare care is very expensive, but the amount that actually trickles down to the physician that is in the room helping you is far less than...
I would say it's actually criminally low is the descriptor I would use.
Well said, well said. And then, like you said, across different professions as well, you know, pediatricians are more like teachers where, you know, they're much needed. Their service is very, very important, but they are not compensated in accordance with what they're dealing with on a day-to-day basis.
So as we wrap up, I really appreciate the opportunity to help people, physicians who are so integral in just making sure that the populace can be happy and healthy and have great medical infrastructure in this country. And Lauren, I don't know how you feel about this, but I, for anybody listening out there who's a doctor, like, I'm grateful that you do what you do. I'm grateful that my wife and that your husband, Lauren, do what they do. And at Student Loan Planner, we're committed. You know, Travis is also married to a physician and we love doctors and we love the way that they give themselves to their work with such intensity and passion and compassion to create a really unique skill set to serve people really well. So thank you, doctors who are out there. And obviously everyone has their own unique role, but we're focused on physicians today. We're grateful for the work that you do and for the financial responsibility that you take on to be able to provide that work to us. And we want to provide every resource that we possibly can to make this road, this journey for you as positive and optimistic and uplifting and financially feasible as we possibly can. So thank you for the work that you do.
You could not have said it better, Justin. I am so grateful to each and every physician for their contribution to society, for the long days, the all-nighters that they put in to get the education that is necessary to be able to save lives. I am proud to wake up next to a husband every day that is fighting cancer in the best way that he can. And when he comes and tells a story about how he has saved a life and you know, how excited a person is to hear that they're now cancer-free, he's my hero all the time. So to all the physicians out there, thank you so much for all you do. If you're looking for a student loan plan, you know where to find us, studentloanplanner.com. And until next week, we shall be talking to you all.
See ya.